Father, I just thank you for giving me the opportunity to teach. I pray today that you would give me your power in my weakness, to use me as a conduit of your grace today, to be able to even begin to teach others what you've taught me this last week. I just pray that I would have clear communication and your spirit would be here with us today as we learn what you have to say to us from your word. Thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so it's a psalm, so I'm just going to read it because it's a poem. And, you know, first things first, it can come hit us with all of its artisticness of David. Yahweh is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Yahweh is the strong defense of my life. Whom shall I dread? When evildoers came upon me to devour my flesh, my adversaries and my enemies, they stumbled and fell. Though a host encamp against me, my heart will not fear. The war rise against me, in this I trust. One thing I have asked from Yahweh that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of Yahweh all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of Yahweh and to inquire in his temple. From the day of calamity he will conceal me in his shelter. In the secret place of his tent he will hide me. He will lift me up on a rock. And now my head will be lifted up above my enemies around me. And I will offer in his tent sacrifices with loud shouts of joy. I will sing and I will sing praises to Yahweh. Hear, O Yahweh, when I call with my voice, and be gracious to me and answer me. On your behalf, my heart says, seek my face. Your face, O Yahweh, I shall seek. Do not hide your face from me. Do not turn your slave away in anger. You have been my help. Do not abandon me and do not forsake me, O God of my salvation. For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but Yahweh will take me up. Instruct me in your way, O Yahweh, and lead me in a level path because of my foes. Do not give me over to the desire of my adversaries. For false witnesses have risen up against me, and such as breathe out violence. I would have despaired unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of Yahweh in the land of the living. Hope in Yahweh. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Hope in Yahweh. So, the first things first is we need to recognize the connection that this psalm has to the previous two. Psalm 25 talks about how God in his love and in his truth to his covenant faithfully saves people. And then in 26, we last week talked about how a justified man stands before Yahweh, saying, this is the difference you've made. This is according to your truth and according to your love, how you have altered me from the man that I once was. And now I stand before you. Please don't cast me out. Judge me that I may stay with you, that I can remain with you in your presence. And here is another one that is going to be predicated on a desire to remain in God's presence based on the fact that he is, we looked last week at the fact that both his love and his truth both have a strong flavor of faithfulness, talking about how God is utterly faithful and the sun will go out before God is not faithful, right? That's the whole idea here, is that God's faithfulness is the absolute rock hard certainty. And today we're going to explore the fact that sometimes we have to hold that in our minds because sometimes that's not what we're seeing. And David is going to talk about the objective truth of who God is and how that relates sometimes to the subjective perception that we have of reality. So starting to go in and parse up the poem here real quick. We start off with, it says, Yahweh is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? And man, do light and salvation have a lot of different things that they can mean because it's poetic language and everything. But because of the fact that it's set in contrast to fear, you know, you can know that we're talking about things that are in contact. You know, God can be seen as moral light. But in this case, I think that he's talking more like, you know, it's dark and it's frightening because you can't see what's out there, right? But the light drives out the darkness. So you can see so you can see, right? And then you're not scared to go out there because there's nothing lurking in the shadows because the light has dispelled the darkness. Darkness can't dispel light. Light dispels darkness, right? And he's our salvation. And, you know, yes, in an ultimate term, that can talk about the fact that he saves us from our sins and all that kind of stuff. But in this case, you know, he's just the one that saves David from whatever is going, you know, he's the one that he relies on for safety and for salvation. So this is talking very much about David and his dependence on Yahweh for his security and his safety. And you can see that in how it's contrasted. Yahweh is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Yahweh is the strong defense of my life. Whom shall I dread? So those two strophes are parallel to each other. Yahweh is the strong defense of his life. Who do you have to fear if the creator of the universe, if the one who has made all things, is the one who defends you? You need fear nothing, right? Because no one can thwart him. No one can defeat him. If he's defending you, you are defended, right? There's no way that anything can get through that. And you can tell that these are synonymous because of the fact that fear and dread are pretty much synonymous. And so these two strophes in this stanza are set at equation. In the next verse, it says, when evildoers come upon me to devour my flesh. Have you ever had that problem? People coming up and trying to like break out the fork and the knife? Well, so obviously this is poetic language. The evildoers that are coming upon David are like wild animals, right? They're out to kill. They're out to take him down. And then like wild animals, the visual image here is of them devouring him like an animal that has just slain its prey. You know, his enemies are like wild beasts coming out to destroy him. And this poetic imagery is there to kind of like call that to mind, how ferocious his enemies are. But it says, my adversaries and my enemies, they stumbled and fell. So, it's you know, this picture here is of not just stumbled, not just fell, stumbled and fell, right? This is a great overthrowing of his enemies. These wild beasts, you know, have completely gone down because of God. His enemies, his wild beast enemies. And then he pulls up an image that David is probably really familiar with. He says, though a host encamp against me, my heart will not fear. The war arise against me, in this I trust. Again, another parallel statement. And for those of you who have never been to war, I've never been to war. War is one of the scariest situations you can be in. Ancient warfare was very scary too, because people would come and they would camp around you, and their whole point was they wanted to kill you once they'd broken your will to fight, and then they wanted to take everything that you owned. And then possibly they would take your family as prisoners, right? And so, I mean, I don't know if any of you guys have ever played football, but only with like sharp things, right? It's really, really scary. If you think that it's scary to, you know, like the mental image of you go out there and you're getting ready to play some football and everything, you know, it's one thing if the other guys are roughly your size, right? But what if they're like, you know, 350 pounds of pure muscle and they look really angry? And before the hike, they're like, I'm going to hurt you, right? Much scarier than that, because these guys have sharp things that they want to put in you, right? And so it's really, really, really scary. And so David is calling this to mind because this is a situation that David had to deal with a lot. David had to deal with fear that comes from the battlefield. And yet he had come to understand this objective reality that nothing can happen to him in this battle, that Yahweh does not permit. Yahweh is his protector. Yahweh is his strength. And so he has nothing to fear because Yahweh is in complete control of the situation. And so he will not fear and he will not dread. Interestingly, this is something that comes up sometimes in class, because I don't know if you know this, but middle school age students are very interested in nuclear weapons. They really are. They're like, Mr. Troyer, what happens in a nuclear blast? And I'm like, well, you know, would we survive it? And I'm like, here? No. No, there's too many aimed at our general area and everything. There's the, you know, I would describe like the different, you know, there's the blast zone. There's the fallout zone. There's the area with heat. right in the core of it and everything. And, you know, they get a little worked up, and I'd say, but guys, you understand that nothing is going to happen that God doesn't let happen. God will have decided from the foundation of the world, we are safe because Yahweh is in control. God is in control of all of this. And so you don't have to worry about it. The only nuclear weapons that are going to get you are the ones that God has permitted since the foundation of the world to come get you. And you can trust him with that, right? And so this is objective reality, but, you know, it can still be scary, right? Because life isn't all objective reality, right? Sometimes you can't see objective reality. And so we're going to move on to a section that I call Joy in God's Presence, which is also talking about objective reality. But it's got, I don't know if you've noticed this, but check out these lines. It's not two strophes to the stanza, it's three, right? There's like A, and then both the next two lines are going to expand on the first line, and the two lines, the BB, are like parallel to each other. So it's a little, and only this little section of three verses has that. And it's like really cool. It says, one thing I have asked from Yahweh that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of Yahweh all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of Yahweh and to inquire in his temple. Right? This is all he wants. Not to win the next battle. What he wants is he wants to see the beauty of Yahweh. He wants to be in his temple. He wants to dwell with him. He wants to dwell in the house of Yahweh all the days of his life, to behold the beauty of Yahweh and to inquire in his temple. It's good that God is the defender of his life. He's in favor of that. But this is his heart's desire. He wants to remain with God, to abide with God. And guys, here we can take a page out of his book. Let's look at John chapter 14, starting in verse 18. Because this heads into the promises that Jesus makes to his disciples. You can't always communicate promises from the Old Testament to the New one-to-one. But here we have one that is going to communicate really well. John 14, 18 through 24. It says, I will not leave you as orphans. This is Jesus speaking to the disciples shortly before his crucifixion. I will come to you, and after a little while, the world will no longer see me, but you will see me. Because I live, you will live also. On that day, you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. He who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and will disclose myself to him. Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, Lord, what then has happened that you are going to disclose yourself to us and not to the world? Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our dwelling with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words, and the word which you have heard is not mine, but the Father's who sent me. So the promise that Jesus has here is he discloses himself. He teaches you about himself. And the Father comes and he dwells with you. The one thing that David wants, he wants to dwell in the presence of God. At this point in history, again, it's a tent, it's inside Jerusalem, but David wants to be as close to God as he possibly can at all times. And that's symbolized by being in, at that time, the tabernacle, which is the symbol of God's presence. And he talks about beholding God's beauty. And again, here we have one of those words that's not always translated the same way. And so it's got a different flavor than you might think with the English word. So I want to look at some other ways that it's translated. It says, behold God's beauty, right? But it's not always pronounced beauty when it's translated into English. First, let's go to Proverbs 16, verse 24. It says, pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. Here it's translated pleasant. So instead of it's talking about beauty, here it's translated pleasant. As in, you know, the pleasant words which are a honeycomb sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. And then, just because it's closer, we can head over to Proverbs 3:17. And it says, her ways are pleasant ways, and all her pathways are peace. This is talking about wisdom's pleasant ways. And here, the same word beauty is translated pleasant. Her ways are pleasant ways, and all her pathways are peace. Now, you knew that this wasn't talking about, like, physical beauty, right? Because God's not visible. He's a spirit, right? So we're talking about a kind of beauty, a pleasantness, a graciousness. Right? A favor. We're talking about an attribute of God, which is being poetically spoken of as beauty, but, you know, God is a spirit. And so does not, you know, we don't see him with our physical eyes. Right. So we're talking about, that. And then Psalm 90:17. It says, let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish us the work of our hands, establish the work of our hands. And so here it's favor, the favor of the Lord. So he wants to behold God's beauty, but it's got kind of a flavor of his favor, his pleasantness, his graciousness, right? He wants to be in the presence of the Lord and experience these things, this Hebrew word that has all these things. And then it talks about inquire of his temple. And without, you know, running into a whole bunch of examples and stuff, there's a word that's much more often when it's talking in the ritual sense of going and inquiring of a god to get an answer and stuff, that is much more often used than the one used here. This one is more, gives the sense of him going just to see God, to come and see his face, and to get to know him better, as opposed to getting an answer to a question or something. But inquiring, you know, of the Lord, you break out the Urim and the Thummim and, you know, shall we go this way or shall we go that way and that kind of stuff. But this word talks more about just trying to get to know God better, is the word that's being used him. And so in this case, it's talking about the case is seeking out God himself as opposed to some sort of specific answer from him. And I would remind you that Jesus told us, the blessed are the pure in heart, for they and they alone shall see God, right? David has that pure heart. He wants one thing. He wants one thing. He wants God. He wants to be in God's presence. He wants to enjoy experiencing his goodness and his favor. And that's his heart. Let's look at verse 5. It says, for in the day of calamity, he will conceal me in his shelter. In the secret place of his tent, he will hide me. Now, interestingly, these are kind of two contrasting ideas. One is you're hidden somewhere so no one can see you. And then in the next stanza, it's going to talk about him being, then it talks about lifting you up on a rock. We've talked about being up on the rock, right? It's not talking about like a little stone or anything. It's a place of safety up higher where no one can get to you, right? And so you can be hidden so no one can find you, or you can be up on top of a rock where people know exactly where you are, but it doesn't do them any good because they can't get to you to do you any harm, right? And so the common thread here is that with his God, there is safety. God will keep him secure. People either can't find you or they can't get to you because you're either hidden or he's up on a rock and he's inaccessible. They can't get to him, right? And so the picture here is the fact that on the day of calamity, on the day that it's horrible, God will keep him safe. His security entirely comes from Yahweh. It says, and now my head will be lifted up above my enemies around me. This speaks of victory, lifting up your head amongst your enemies around you. You are victorious. Your enemies have been defeated, right? His head is lifted up. Victory is given to him. and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with loud shouts of joy. I will sing praises to Yahweh. And so here's his response. Worship, loud praise, thanksgiving, singing, joy. As a result of the fact that God has saved him, has rescued him from the day of calamity, from all the horrible things that were happening to him, the objective truth is that his security rests firmly in his God, the God that he just wants to spend time with. He just wants to be in his presence all the time. And then the tone shifts. The tone shifts just a little bit here. He says, "Hear, O Yahweh, when I call with my voice, and be gracious to me, and answer me." Why is he asking Yahweh to hear him? Well, probably because he's like crying out, and he's not hearing an answer. He's like, "Yahweh, the day of calamity. I know that on the day of calamity, it is you who saves. I know it's you who gives me my rescue. And it's happening. It's happening, Lord. Bad things going on. Where are you? Where are you? It's happening. Hear me. Hear me, Lord. Where are you? Be gracious to me and answer me." This next stanza is so interesting. "On your behalf, my heart says, seek my face. Your face, O Yahweh, I shall seek." But it's kind of hard to translate. People translate it differently. But his heart is calling out, just seek Yahweh. And he's like, yes, I will seek out Yahweh. And then I'll be saved. Because I know the truth. I know he's my salvation. The day of trial has come. I'm calling out. I don't hear him. I'll seek him. Let me seek Yahweh. Let me find him. He's telling himself, go seek God. You know the truth. He's like, yes. And so he's seeking God. "Don't hide your face from me. Don't turn your slave away in anger. Where are you? Have I done something wrong? Don't turn me away. My enemies are triumphing over me. This isn't how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to be my stronghold. You're supposed to be the one that hides me. Where are you? I know the truth. I'm just not experiencing it. My enemies are tearing my flesh. You have been my help. Do not abandon me and do not forsake me, O God of my salvation." It's like a little kid. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but you're in the store and you're looking at the things and you look up and you have to be like really little, like 3 or 4 or something, right? And you look up and mom's gone. Nobody's around. You've never been out of their presence before, right? I mean, not unless you were with grandma and grandpa or something, right? You're alone in this store. You have no idea what to do. Where's God? Because seriously, I'm not going to be able to function if he's not here. Where are you? How do I cope with this if God is not my defender? Don't turn away. You're all I have. And this is when you recall to mind. Remember, these psalms are about God's love, which is faithfulness, and his truth, which is faithfulness. So don't fool yourself. He's there. David just isn't seeing him. And he's in distress. But God is there. And he can't see it. And he's in distress because of it. Because God is there. Everything in him is faithfulness. Verse 10. For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but Yahweh will take me up. There's no indication that David's father and mother ever forsook him. We don't have any idea that that ever happened. I don't know. Maybe we just weren't told about it. But the idea here poetically is the shot is on the board for my parents to throw me under the bus. Maybe it's not likely. Maybe nobody loves you like your mom and your dad. But the shot is still on the board that your parents might throw you under the bus for some reason. But not God. God isn't going to do that. He is all faithful. David is calling out, I know the truth. I know how it is. I'm just not experiencing it. My enemies are all over me. Shouldn't my head be lifted up? Shouldn't I be having victory? Should I not be defended upon a rock? Where is my light in this darkness? Where is my salvation as my enemies swarm me? We have to figure out, because I don't know about you, but I've been in this situation myself, how to maintain your mind on what is objectively true when around you things are subjectively not going the way you think they ought to. Because, you know, let's face it. Could God, you know, he owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. You could live in a mansion. You could drive a Lamborghini. God can do anything he wants. But this is where we come face to the face with the fact that we serve God. Not we don't have a genie that serves us. Right? And maybe he's up to something else. In fact, he is. And then we talk, notice that 7 to 10 is David's distress because of his sense, his not sensing God's presence. And 11 and 12 is just the adversaries. He's more upset about not seeing God come to his rescue than he is about the adversaries, right? They only get two verses. Verse 11, instruct me in your way, O Yahweh, and lead me in a level path because of my foes. Your enemies are looking for an opportunity. They want to catch you bending so they can get you, right? But how can they catch you bending if you're being morally upright? And again, you see this thread running through 25, 26, 27. Teach me your ways. Teach me to be righteous. My righteousness comes from you, right? Teach me to do what's right. Teach me to be the right kind of person. My enemies want to catch me bending. Teach me what's right. Lead me on a level path. Do not give me over to the desire of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and such as breathe out violence. So in this case, David's not talking about, it doesn't say what the occasion is, but he's not talking about a battlefield situation here. Here we get a clue. His enemies are false witnesses and breathing out violence. And obviously, since his adversaries are not dragons, right, this is a poetic way of talking about the fact that his enemies are trying to harm him with what they're saying, right? They're false witnesses. They're breathing out violence. They're trying to destroy him with what they're saying. Don't give them the satisfaction. Don't give me over to their desires because they want me to go down. They want to destroy me. That's why they're saying horrible things about me. And then he comes to the conclusion. This is the part where he tells us what he wants us to take away from all of this, right? He says, I would have despaired unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of Yahweh in the land of the living. To avoid despair, you have to believe that the objective truth, even though you're not experiencing it at this exact moment, is the objective truth, and it is what is going to come about. God is the salvation. You may not be experiencing it right now, but in the end, when you look back, you're going to be, oh yeah. He held me up on a rock. Hope in Yahweh. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Hope in Yahweh. You notice the repetition, right? Right? Hope in Yahweh. That's the point. Keep your mind focused on Yahweh. Keep your focus, your eyes focused on the Lord. That's the message here. And then he says, be strong and let your heart take courage. Guys, I don't know if anyone, you know, you'll be going around the place and somebody will say a movie line, right? And you'll know where it comes from and everything. Inconceivable, right? And then it'll like draw up another occasion. Bible does this all the time, okay? And be strong and let your heart take courage is this thing in the Old Testament. Let me read you some passages. I like printed them out here so you guys didn't have to wait a long time while I found them. Deuteronomy 3:28, second giving of the law. Moses writes, but command Joshua and strengthen him and encourage him, for he shall go across at the hand of his people, and he will cause them to inherit the land which you will see. Strengthen him and encourage him. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Exact same words. In the Hebrew, exact same words. Deuteronomy 31:1-8. So Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel, and he said to them, I am 120 years old today. I am no longer able to come and go. And Yahweh has said to me, you shall not cross this Jordan. It is Yahweh your God who will cross ahead of you. He will destroy these nations before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua is the one who will cross ahead of you, just as Yahweh has spoken. And Yahweh will do to them just as he did to Zihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites, and to their land, which he destroyed them. And Yahweh will give them over before you, and you shall do to them according to all the commandments which I have commanded you. Be strong and courageous. Those are the words again. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or be in dread of them, for Yahweh your God is the one who goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Then Moses called to Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and courageous. For you shall go with this people into the land which Yahweh has sworn to your fathers to give them, and he shall give it to them as an inheritance. And Yahweh is the one who goes ahead of you. He will be with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed. David is saying the exact same thing. He's saying, be strong and courageous. The fight is before you. The enemies are before you. Be strong and courageous. Your God goes with you. Hope in Yahweh. Hope in Yahweh. You guys ever read Joshua chapter 1? You remember how often that gets repeated in Joshua chapter 1? Oh my goodness. It's like, what, 4 or 5 times in there? Be strong and courageous. Only be strong and courageous. It's like the theme of Joshua 1. Go in there, be strong and courageous. Exact same words in the Hebrew, right? It's also in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. When the Assyrians think that they are going to take out Hezekiah after they've already destroyed the northern kingdom. They're coming to deal with Hezekiah. And God says to Hezekiah, be strong and courageous. Yahweh is with you. And we all know how that turned out. Some things for us to think about as we move into application of this thing is, first of all, that God loves to display his power in weakness, so that there is absolutely no question about who gets the glory for what happened. We see that in the story of Gideon's army, where Gideon has too big an army. And so God keeps on winnowing it down until there's absolutely no way they're going to blame that army for winning the battle against the Midianites. No way. Also, David and Goliath. And I think that the story of David and Goliath, the story of David and Goliath is instructive in many ways about this whole idea of keeping your eyes on what's objectively true against seeing what is subjectively in front of your face, right? Because here we have the situation that is subjectively the most unfair thing you can possibly imagine. And it is, in fact, even more unfair than you remember. Because you'll remember, probably, that Goliath was 9 feet tall and a veteran of many battles. And David did not study the nunchuck. He did not study the sword. He was not a trained warrior. He was a shepherd. He sat around the place and he watched sheep all the time, right? And yet, this boy goes out to face Goliath. And in fact, this fight is even less fair because something happened in 1200 BC, which was just about 200 years before this, called the Bronze Age Collapse, where the ability to make bronze weapons disappeared. And only a certain number of people were able to make iron weapons anymore. And the Philistines were one of them. The Israelites were not. It says that there were only two swords in all of Israel, one in the hand of Saul, one in the hand of his son Jonathan. And otherwise, the Israelites had to go to the Philistines to even get their farm implements sharpened because they couldn't work metal. These guys are using pointy sticks, okay? They are not armed with high technology. Goliath is covered in metal armor with sharp metal in his hands. David has nothing like that. And you know that the Philistines have been lords over the Israelites all this time because otherwise they wouldn't have to go and beg for their items to be sharpened. They would demand it of the Philistines. And so the Philistines are in the hill country of Judah, in their land, roughing them up. And David comes out, and if you remember, what was his reaction when he hears the taunt of the Philistines? Because all too often, people think that David's reaction was, "My goodness, that's frightening. Well, I will take courage in the Lord, and I will go and fight, for the Lord is strong." That's not his reaction at all. He's like, "Did I just hear what I thought I heard? You get my God's name out of your mouth. Somebody shut his face. Who? Why have you not killed him yet? I'll kill him. I'll kill him. Shut your face, giant." And Saul's like, David, you're going to get yourself killed. Would you like a sword? I got a sword. You can have a sword. Nah, I don't need a sword. I need to kill this man." And he goes down there. He is hot. He is angry. This man has opened his mouth in the presence of Yahweh. And then you think that when David is out there, he comes up to Goliath and he's just like smarting off or something. He's like, "I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts." No, this man is saying the scariest thing these Philistines have heard. Because you understand, Yahweh has a history in that land. 400 years before that, the mightiest kingdom that these people know of, the people who defeated the Philistines and resettled them on the coast, the people who beat them up and put them on the coast, had their country wrecked by Yahweh. And you think they don't know about that? Cast your mind back to the Elides. You know Eli with the two evil sons that Solomon has to come and replace? When they go out, they lose a battle to the Philistines. Because of course they do. The Philistines are better than them, right? They're like, "Well, we know what we're going to do. We're going to get the Ark of the Covenant," right? So they grab the Ark of the Covenant. And they go out and everyone's shouting, "Yay, we got the Ark of the Covenant," right? And you know what the Philistines' reaction was? "Oh, snap. It's the Ark of the Covenant. Yahweh is going to butter us across this field." That's their reaction. They're like, "Oh, snap, we're all dead. Oh, well. Let's fight like men. Our families depend on us. Let's go." And they won. They won that battle. But their reaction was, not Yahweh. You know what he did to Egypt. You know what he did to the Amorites. You know what he did to the Canaanites. If Yahweh's involved, our lives are forfeit. And so when David comes out to fight the giant, and he's like, "I come to you in the name of Yahweh," and they're like, "I certainly hope not." But when the shepherd murders the giant, they're not running from David. They're running from Yahweh. Because, oh snap, Yahweh is here. Because the giant died to the shepherd. That boy was telling the truth. Because they knew what was going on. Right? Now there is one difference here between this understanding the objective truth, which David did, which was understanding that this fight was super unfair because it wasn't David against Goliath. It was the creator of the universe against some 9-foot tall critter that he created, right? He understood the objective truth. But the difference is that David got to stand there on the field of battle with a sword and a giant's head while everyone ran past and got to be vindicated. Whereas in this psalm, the objective truth is true, but maybe the vindication hasn't come. Maybe you're still having to deal with that. You're still having to wait and hope in Yahweh, despite the fact that that vindication hasn't come in the way that would be so satisfying, where you're standing there with your foot on the giant, right? That Yahweh has taken him out. He's dealt with him. And you know that there were problems like that that David had to deal with that he never got to see the end of. Because if you look at the end of his reign, he goes to his son Solomon. And he's like, son, there are these people. And I need you to deal with them because they've never been dealt with. Right? And so then there's like this whole series with Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada. And so there are a lot of people that did David wrong that didn't get their comeuppance while David was around. And he had to live with waiting for those people to get what they have coming to them. And so we cry out in our trials because God can do anything. God is good. So why isn't he helping us in the way that we want? And we're supposed to be strong and take courage. Because when we can't see it, God is still losing complete control. This morning, Pastor Camacho told us there's one thing that we can do on earth that we can't in heaven. I submit to you there's a second. Because once we get to glory, we're no longer going to be able to yearn to see the salvation of the Lord and to wait. Because then we're going to see things as they are. And waiting for the Lord, knowing that he can save, having to wait for his salvation until it comes, is kind of, it's almost like an exquisite suffering and pain that draws you as it goes on to more and more. If your heart is focused on the objective truth, it draws you more and more to say, why don't you come? I know you're going to come. And you continue to focus on God and his salvation in a way that you wouldn't if that didn't happen. It's like a little kid. You know, you guys know that if you go to the store and every time a kid wants something, you give it to them, they don't appreciate it, right? And the more you want something, the more wonderful it is when you get it, right? The more you appreciate it, the more you give credit to the one that gives it to you, right? And so there is this exquisite suffering that draws our hearts and gives us something far more precious than deliverance from the trial, far more precious than a Lamborghini, far more precious than material prosperity. We're drawn into closeness with God himself. He's giving us the most important thing. He's giving us himself. As we yearn for him, as we cry out for him, as we say, where are you in my trials? You could solve this by yourself. And he will. But as we wait, as we are strong and courageous, as we hope in the Lord, our hearts are drawn to him. And we find something far more valuable. The ability to take our joy from him alone instead of our joy from him plus the Lamborghini or him plus the problem-free life or him plus all these other things that we want so badly. Our closeness and satisfaction to him grows as we learn to lean on him and wait for him patiently. In the end, then, we can say with David, Yahweh is my light and my salvation. Who shall I fear? And that is all I found, you guys. I hope it is of some use to you.